All right, you ready, sister? We're casual here.
Let's give it a go.
Welcome to the Surrounded by Valor podcast. By popular demand, I have my buddy, I was going to say bestie buddy Megan on.
Our bestie buddies.
Right. And we're going to begin today with another segment of deep thoughts, piggybacking on last week on our very important discussion about candy. Now, I created an Instagram poll, Megan, and it was weird because I was like, I forgot what the first one was, but it seemed like the overwhelming majority of people voted against the mellow cream pumpkin. So I felt that data was obviously not valid. Maybe it was opposite day. And then I created another one, and I must be unclear in how I'm presenting the question because it seemed like the overwhelming majority was saying no. What do you feel about that?
Which ultimately means more for us, because I don't think Brock's is stopping production on the mellow cream pumpkins anytime soon. However, I don't quite understand. I think your first poll, by the way, was the Cadbury cream egg. I'm not sure what the results on that, but I feel like the mellow cream pumpkins is for some reason more offensive to people.
Right. Someone said texture. Someone said, like, this will shock you, that there's too much sugar in it.
Okay, so I have a follow-up, if you'll do me the honor.
Please.
And this might create quite a stir amongst your podcast listeners and your Instagram followers. The Shamrock Shake.
Oh, hell yes.
So these squirrely beasts I started consuming sometime, I think, in high school. Yes. Maybe like after swim practice or something like that.
Before they made the top the dome and added the whipped cream and the cherry. There was that era.
Oh.
Wait a second.
I didn't love that. I'm talking old school straight up.
Flat top. Just regular. Okay, good. For a second there, I thought you didn't live in the era. But then I'm like, wait a second.
No, that came and went, I feel like.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Because again, this falls into the, like, you can really only consume one once a year.
Yeah.
And so fun fact about me is to know me is to know I'm a car snack girl, right?
Are you?
I'm a big car snack girl. I also did not buy a certain car once because when I sat in it to test drive it, the center console did not have enough room for me to put car snacks.
Do you take a coffee mug and like test out the size of the mug holder in a car?
Yes. Yeah. So you need to have one cup holder for the cup, but then the other cup holder is either for snacks, and then your backup snacks are in the center console, right, as well as your car door pocket.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, agreed.
So that's where car snacks need to live because it's easily accessible. Right. So
do you have a liner in these or do you just go straight to the cup holder? Or do you have like a special silicone liner in it?
No. And anyone that ever is in my car, you will never come in my car and not find everything with a slight sugar coating.
So if we're desperate, we could lick it.
Right. So Shamrock Shake,
yes.
Perfect for a car snack.
True.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Mellow pumpkins. Great.
Exactly. No crumbs.
Car snack.
Mm-hmm.
Then comes the great debate of the Cadbury cream egg versus the Cadbury mini egg.
This is the mini egg, I feel, would fit into the cup holder. Again, no crumbs.
No crumbs. Cadbury cream egg, not a good person.
There's a little bit of mess involved in that.
I've tried. I get that, whatever that yellow, white sugar nonsense on the inside becomes all over you as you're driving down the Mass Pike. It's not a great scene. Right.
Now, what do you think about, and I know this answer, the people who post the quote, healthy Shamrock Shakes recipes.
Get out of town.
Yeah, don't even.
Either do it or you don't.
Right.
We're because not if I'm having a healthy Shamrock Shake, it's now becoming my daily breakfast.
Right.
Right? Because you've now made an excuse that it's healthy to eat them.
Right.
So now it's a salad, and now I'm a healthy person for consuming it. I need the full original Shamrock Shake, because then you can put guardrails on it.
Yes. You know what else is a good car snack then, which is on our agenda today, is the Easter bunny. No.
He's such a bunny. He's a good car passenger.
Yeah, the jelly bean. Again, no crumbs.
Again, Brock's.
Right. Now, I don't know if I told you this, but remember when we ran a couple weeks ago?
Yes.
And that guy was in the parking lot.
I drove away while you were running. And then you told me after. So to give the listeners a little bit of background, I was lucky enough to run with Mary a couple weeks ago when I was out in New York. And she was trying out some new fancy fast shoes after we were done. And as I was driving away, I saw Mary running towards the canal, and I saw this fine gentleman following her. Did I give it a second thought that maybe I shouldn't drive away? No.
No.
Nah.
Like, I had to redirect him.
And then after the fact, I get a text that says, oh my gosh, this guy wouldn't stop running with me.
Well, he did. But what was more exciting than that, believe it or not, was that I found some old jelly beans in the pocket. And I mean, they were probably a month old, but that's something that never goes old. Again, no crumbs, really no expiration dates.
No, and they're also a good seasonal, because you can get kind of what you said last week. All of these are available on Amazon all day, every day.
We do not break this rule. We do not.
No, when you were really sad a few months ago, I was like, maybe I will send her a truckload, a literal truckload of Mellow Cream Pumpkins. But I feel like if we start sending those things in the mail,
right, it becomes a precedent, because I have thought the same thing to send to you. And then I'm like, we can't break the code.
Right. So jelly beans are great. The Brock's ones, perfect. Fantastic. Yes. I will also try to only eat those around Easter. Mm-hmm. So that's a car snack where if you put it center console, you're eating those by the handful. I've crushed an entire bag of Brock's jelly beans in a 2-hour road trip. And you know that sweet nausea that hits you like a ton of bricks? Most people are like, oh my God, my stomach hurts. I feel that. And I'm like, success.
Yes. It's almost like a PR.
Yeah, I did it.
The mile.
Oof.
It is amazing, though, how much less volume it takes to get that feeling from the Mellow Cream Pumpkins.
Yeah, and to the lovely people that talk about the texture, you got to fight through. Because once you realize that Play-Doh texture, honestly, it brings you back to your childhood. Who didn't eat Play-Doh, right?
There have been times where I was playing with Play-Doh with my niece, and I'm like, oh man, I could go in the summer. I'm like, oh, Mellow Cream Pumpkin season's coming.
So good. Actually, this could link all of this seasonal candy talk back to actual training.
Oh, really?
Thoughts on, so we have obviously Morton's, pause for dramatic financial effect. Goose, we have all of the fanciest fuels available to us right now in 2024. But I don't know about you, when I was doing Ironman and I was recovering or I was in an off season, I used to use a lot of these candy corn, Mellow Cream Pumpkins as fuel on like bike rides or something. And, you know, and people kind of say you only do it when it's off season, you're only doing it when it's an easy ride, and you shouldn't be using these pure sugar candies to fuel yourself for long efforts. But I feel like they can't be, there's got to be a place for them. And, or is that something people used to do back in the day? Right.
I coached a woman in, it was probably 2006, and she was an engineering type, and she compared, because at the time there was like goo Cliff Bar gels, and she did a full-on comparison of jelly beans to gels. And at that time, she believed they were equivalent. She did Ironman Lake Placid all on jelly beans, and she qualified for Kona. I don't think that she qualified for Kona because she fueled on jelly beans. I think it had a lot to do with her preparation also, but her nutrition that day on jelly beans was spot on.
And in Kona, her kit is a giant candy corn. It's orange and white.
Is it Jelly Belly or something?
No, it's interesting though, right? Because we've just gone so far.
Oh my God.
With fuel, with tech, with science, with all of those things. And I do, it's definitely, it's a thing and it should be used. But when I do think back to, 20 years ago, what we were using or what could we be using or those comparisons, I do think it's super interesting, right?
Yeah, it would be interesting to like compare, really compare, like with the sugars, obviously, is what you're looking at, right?
Carbs. I'm sure those mellow cream pumpkins are slammed with carbs.
We should get a qualified board certified registered dietitian here to like break this down for us.
She would probably just laugh and walk away.
Yeah, that is also true. But this does segue into our next segment, which was the things that have changed with racing. And first on our agenda is the good old Timex watch. Remember when we used to like, if you're like, okay, I'm going to run, let's just say 10 miles. And then you'd go drive a route and then you would just time it.
And that was before your car had the, like, where you could automatically set like a trip ticker. And like, okay, this has been like 10 miles. It was literally, I don't know about for you, but for me, staring at my odometer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just trying to figure out, and you're not really looking at the miles. You're looking at the overall loop. And then my friend Lisa and I used to run from her house all the time and we'd go out and we'd hash the mile marks with chalk of our runs. And, you know, you just start your Timex. There's no GPS. There's no nothing. You start it. And often what we would do is this is when we were training. I was training for my first marathon, Vermont City Marathon. We ran in 2003. No, it was 2004. It was 2004. And we would do like an 18-mile run. Yeah. And you do the run and you come back and you look at the total time on your watch. And then you start dividing to try to figure out what start your average pace was. Yeah, and then you put it in like your little, like your hard paper, you know, training log.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That with the spiral notebook. I still keep one of those.
Yeah. I actually, I did a 50 miler in 2012 and we were still doing that. I think it was on the precipice of more GPS watches, but I had asked Lisa to say, hey, can you send me our Stonecat 50 miler training? Because I wanted to kind of see how I did long runs, how I set up my week. And it was so funny. She sent me a literal Excel spreadsheet.
Oh my God.
And it was like the date we ran, how many miles we ran, and like what our average, like, because you didn't keep a run on your watch.
Right. Oh, so, yeah.
And chances are you're not, I know for me, I wasn't keeping my 5 mile runs.
Right.
Right. You're keeping we were keeping our midweek long runs and our long runs.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Oh my God. And then one of the things, like, I don't know if you ever noticed this, but like when I started coaching and GPS watches started coming into play, athletes would stop in transition, hold their wrist up to the sky. And I'd be like, what are you doing? I'm locating. And I'd be like, you can still run. You know what I mean? But you had to always stop and try to locate. And that was like the first time that I noticed the big dependence on the GPS, you know?
So do you think that that's experience or do you think that that's where we were in technology then versus now? Because I would almost push back that even however many years later, it wouldn't shock me to see people in transition doing the same thing.
Right.
And I don't think it's someone who maybe has a ton, like, I don't think it's someone who's done 75 Ironmans who's doing it, but someone who's maybe new to the sport that is like, they're doing the PEMDAS, right? I need to do like A before B before C.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, right? Because even myself, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, I was standing out in my driveway. Yeah. Wrist up to the sky being like, I just want to start my run.
Yeah.
Like, just give me satellite. And then I'm like, come on, just run.
Yeah.
I'll catch up eventually.
Yeah.
You know,
I think you're right. I get a lot of athletes who are new, like now, who the first thing they say to me, like, if we're doing like a coaching call, what kind of watch should I get? And my answer is always like, any watch is fine. Like, I'm not going to make a financial decision for you because you can spend, if you want a regular Timex watch, I'm very cool with that. If you want a $5,000 watch, that's fine too. We never use more than like an eighth of what the watch has anyway. Right. You know what I mean? But it's almost like today's athlete needs to have that data to learn their body. Whereas I feel like when we came up before technology, because we etched things in stone, we knew our body, and then the technology came in to say, yeah, you're on, or no, you're off. So it's almost like we're coming at it in two different angles, if that makes sense.
No, it's interesting because I do think that coming up with a Timex watch, and you and I were swimmers too, if you really want to, like,
we weren't allowed to wear anything.
Oh my gosh, they have goggles now that somehow in your goggles apparently give you data, which like they would last 4 seconds on my head before they would get ripped off.
I bought a pair. And I haven't really used them. I can maybe use them for a set. It's very weird. Very weird. So I wanted to see what it was like, but go ahead.
Don't like it. But I do think that we had to learn, to your point, you know, how does my body feel?
Yeah.
Right. And for us, I think it was probably at a time, you know, you're in your early 20s, late teens, whatever it was. Think you're just super one more, maybe, I don't want to say more competitive, but it's definitely a different mindset, right? Where it's like, got to be better than yesterday on every single run you're doing, right? Yeah. And so I remember I would get back from a run and my whole rest of my day would be dependent on the number in that watch.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I did learn, well, I felt like I was flying today.
Yeah.
And I ran X pace. My watch isn't reflecting how I feel, you know? And so it kind of forces you to learn that about yourself and also push past the emotion of it almost.
Yeah. Like, how many times have you done a run and you're like, I am Kipchoge today. I am awesome. And then you look at your watch and you're like, oh my God, that pace quote sucked. Never minding that like you've done a 50 mile a week the week before, and it's just training load and training fatigue. You know what I mean? We've all done that. And I'm like, we don't judge how our run was based on the pace anymore. You know what I mean? But we've all gone through that where we've been like, man, I'm a world record holder. And then you're like, oh my God, I'm going to be that. Like, just because of the number.
Well, and God forbid too, your Garmin is off that day, right?
I was about to say that. I've had Garmins that were wrong.
I think the majority of us run similar loops or ride similar loops probably daily, right?
Yeah.
And there's been times where my watch has spit out, you know, for the same exact 2 mile stretch.
Right.
A 12 minute mile. And then 3 days later, it spits out an 8:30 mile. And I always tell myself, if you're not going to believe the watch on the bad days, you also can't believe the watch on the good days. You have to go by like how your body is feeling.
Yes. Right? 100%. 100%. And I think like the other thing I think is kind of using that to piggyback into like the race week stuff. Like I was telling one of my athletes this week, I was like, listen, if what we do the week before a race is that important, why would we even bother training in January? You know what I mean? So it's less important. Like we're all going to Chattanooga 70.3 and we've got like, I don't know, 14 days. So like this week she's going out of town and she's going to miss a couple rides, but she's been consistent January, you know, till now. And I'm like, it's not that important. So we, you know, we hang our hat on that data point a week before a race, but we forget about the 5 months of consistent training that went before that. You know what I mean? And this is also the week where people are like, oh, I'm sick. Oh, it's not going to be a PR. We write the end of that story before we get to the actual story. I'm kind of
agree. And do you think that's because we just have so much data that we do get in our heads that, oh, I'm going to go out of town. I might miss a couple days of training. Yeah. And, you know, you can see all of your watches and all of, you know, Training Peaks or VDOT or Garmin Connect or whatever you're using telling you, maybe you're recovering or you're detraining or, you know, you're getting that data constantly pushed at you.
Yes. And then you're saying, then that builds up your anxiety. So I think what athletes do pre-race is almost say that, well, it's not going to be a PR day, or I'm kind of sick, or I haven't this or that, to like quell the anxiety. You know what I mean? And truly what we need to do is, you know, anything can happen on race day. A personal record and a personal best are so different, you know? And how can we really, like, how a 20-minute 5K on a flat course is very different than a 21-minute 5K up a mountain when it's sleeting. You know what I mean? We keep these weird comparisons. And how many of your best races are not best times? Ever.
Yeah, I can think of a few. Yeah, I can think of a few off the top of my head that you walk away and you're like, I left everything out there, and that was the smartest race I've ever run in my life.
Yeah.
You know, something silly, like I did the Dopey Challenge in 2022, like 2 Januaries ago, right? Mm-hmm. And that one, it's in Disney World, and it's a 5K on Thursday, a 10K on Friday, a half marathon Saturday, marathon Sunday, right?
Plus all the walking you have to do, and the they need to
that as it's insane, right? Because it's Disney, it's walking to a bus, it's walking to the start. I remember every single day you'd go to bed the night of the 5K, you'd have, you know, 10 miles of walking. The night of the 10K, you had a half marathon of walking.
Yeah.
So by the time you get to the marathon, I mean, you are just, I shouldn't generalize. I was trashed.
Yeah.
Right. And I didn't travel with my boots. I didn't travel with all of the things because I was trying to shove everything in a carry-on bag, you know?
Right.
But I remember finishing that marathon and thinking, I nailed these 4 days.
Right.
I think that's the slowest marathon I've ever run in my life.
Right.
But it was
like the best race.
I was so proud of the way that, you know, you run the 5K and then you recover and then you run the 10K. And then it's like, okay, well, I've done 3 miles on one day and then 6 miles the next day. It's that marathon, half marathon, back to back. Right.
Yeah.
And I had never done that before, but yeah, that was probably the slowest marathon I've ever run before. But it is, for that, it take all timing devices out of the picture, because nothing in that is going to reflect, could possibly reflect, the energy I was outputting over those 4 days.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That makes sense. So right to the point, your best race, it was a personal best, not necessarily a PR based on a marathon in a different part of a country. You know what I mean? Right.
In January in Florida, where it's just a little bit warmer, tiny bit more humid. It's weird. So how do you, as a coach now, do you coach differently now with technology than you did maybe 10 or 15 years ago?
And it's funny because when I was on a team that was very data centric, I started my first coaching company in 2004, 2008 or 9 or 10, I think I sold it and joined this more data centric group. A lot of kind of run by an engineer who, you know, in all fairness to him, he was very spreadsheet oriented and it was logical. It just didn't always incorporate, and this is not the right way to say it, the human aspect of it. And he was a very good coach and stuff. I'm generalizing that too much. There's a better way I could explain that. And then I found that, you know, during those years, it was so much about the data. Then it's all the power meters. It's heart rate, power meters, and people were doing races based on spreadsheets rather than based on how I feel today. My best example, I can't remember what year it was, but Ironman Lake Placid, so we have that 10K descent, right? This year was the first year ever where the wind was blowing up the descent. Like you had to, I think it was 2007, you had to pedal going down. I can't remember. I'm so elderly. So that took everybody's quote power plans that day and flipped them. So race morning, we're recalculating. And one of my athletes was like, can I just ride and like set it as I go? And I was like, what are we doing? We're trying to calculate out this race and taking away an athlete's ability to like go for it when they need to go for it. You know what I mean? So I would say that now I'm I'm kind of on, I went like a bell curve. I'm more about no, like, I want athletes to at least wear a heart rate monitor. I look at that more than they do. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I really try to work with athletes to feel their own pace and feel their body because they do know it. You know, we have all these coaches who are like, you don't know your body. You don't know your body. I'm like, actually, you grow up knowing your body. And you have to get out there and figure out where your line is to cross. But only you know that. Your Garmin does not always know that.
Right. In an instance like that, the Lake Placid race that you're talking mm-hmm. about, you potentially, by recalculating and putting out all of this data to athletes 2 hours before a race.
Yeah, right.
So it's as from an athlete perspective, I'm not a coach, but from an athlete perspective, I'm watching the weather 10 days out. I'm watching the weather 5 days out. I'm already internally starting to freak out, right? About that wind coming up the descent, about, you know, any other potential weather factors that are getting in my brain, but I've got my numbers, right? So I'm memorizing my numbers. I'm memorizing where I need to be on the day. And then someone flipping that script a little bit or even tweaking that script.
Right.
12 hours before a race from an athlete perspective. Now I'm all in my head.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh. This weather must be worse than I even originally thought.
Right.
If we're having to change my power numbers, then what's that going to feel like? Cause I know what this number feels like, but what's this number going to feel like?
I got to write this all out on my leg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Sharpie.
Fact, I had an athlete this week who their training partner said to me, they're like, oh, I think she's going to go this time next week at Gulf Coast. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I mean, this person tends to be a little bit more, and people are different and that's fine, tends to be more results oriented. Yep. And I was like, we don't talk about finish times. We're going to focus on heat management, fueling, pacing, because the wind at Gulf Coast, if it's a red flag day, which is, you know, dangerous water, that wind can sway that race 30 minutes in either way at the same effort. It also may cancel the swim. So we cancel the swim. And then what are we going to do with that number? You know what I mean? So like, it all goes to the point of we focus on the process, not the outcome. Mm-hmm. But people get so focused on like, oh, I got to break this time, or I got to break this time. And I, you know, George Mumford, who is the sports performance coach for Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, he teaches that like, it's in trying not to score that we can score. And again, bringing us back to the process, we got to focus on being excellent at what we do, the heat management and all that. But it's amazing to me how just we're so focused on writing the end of the story before it happens, or planting these arbitrary numbers when so many other factors can get in the way. And then you worry about this time that's just, you're just going to chase all day. You know what I mean? Did that make sense?
No, it totally does. Because when you actually come back to like 35,000 foot level, right? And you look at the top, the cream of the crop, the top of the top in the sport, mm-hmm. what are they doing? They're racing.
Yeah.
They're not trying to like, you know, set it and forget it. Well, maybe they are. Like, I guess if you put a marathoner on like a Chicago course or a London course or a Berlin course, it is kind of set it and forget it. But you also have competitors that ultimately, if they start running a little bit faster, or if it's hot, or if it's, you know, your coach, if you're Emma Bates's coach, you're not going to be like, well, it's going to be hot today.
Yeah.
So why don't you just hang back with the 4 hour marathoners and just like, we'll forget about it. No, she's going to race.
Yeah.
Right. And then you start talking about tactical courses, right?
Yeah.
Like you said about Gulf Coast with the heat and the humidity, et cetera. The marathon version of that is a New York or a Boston. They're tactical, hard courses versus a flat course. And if you're any of those pros, you're going out there and you're racing.
Yes.
And I get that maybe for us mere plebeians, it's not really a race in terms of, actually, even if we were to, I don't know if I'm running when I'm running. Well, who are all the 40-year-olds that I'm running around?
Yeah, exactly.
Similar when you're racing, I think it's, you're in the water, you come out, you have no idea who's ahead of you, who's behind you, you get on a bike. And so it is, it's super interesting, right?
Yeah,
the use of technology, the placement of it versus just going out there and you've done enough workouts to know what your body feels like.
100%. 100%. You know when you're over your skis, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Shalane Flanagan had an interview a couple of years ago where she said her husband is also a marathoner. He's an age grouper. And she was like, professional marathoning, I envy him because something like he can set his watch and he's going to go run a 3-hour marathon. I got to respond to surges. I have no plan. I'm not setting a pace and running. I got to see what the group is doing. So much of what I do is reactive. So she was like, I can't wait when I retire. I'm just going to set the pace and hold it. It's going to be wonderful. So she was like, you know, you don't think about that. If you think about Boston, you know what I mean? Just what happened with Emma Bates leading the race. You know, she wasn't like, I need to stay at a heart rate of 120 or 120. I'm sure it wasn't.
250. Oh, but it's true, right? It's like you hear Des Linden talk about this a lot too, where it's, well, the pace group went out and it was too hot for me.
Yeah.
Like, I know if I go with that pace, I'm going to blow up because right. That is not, I know how my body feels.
Yes.
At that pace, and that's not it. So I'm going to run back here where I know how my body should feel at mile 5 of a marathon.
Yeah.
And just hope that some of these people come back to me.
Right. Or as right? the race, for some of us, we unroll the carpet as the race goes on. We
yes. get closer
to the end. So by taking it out at a too hot pace, by mile 20, I'll be walking.
Okay. It's totally true. It's totally
it's
true.
It's so funny how we've complicated things so much. And Kurt and I were talking about that this morning. You know, my husband's been racing for, oh my God, 40 years, maybe 30 years. And we were talking this morning about how we're like that generation that, and this will tie into like what we have on the list too, is we started with the Timex watches. I mean, when I was racing pro, there was no social media, no Facebook. We just signed up and raced. So much of the sport right now with the technology and the social media and all of this, I don't know if it's unnecessary pressure exists that we just never had before. It's made it very busy. Like, you know,
it's constant information coming at you and it's a lot of your peers. And, you know, everyone says it's cliche at this point where it's like Instagram is the highlight reel, but
yeah. Oh,
and that can absolutely be the case, but nevertheless, whether it is or it isn't, it's what you see.
Yeah.
And it's human nature to not, I mean, you can't not digest that. Right.
Oh, yeah.
It's,
yeah.
It
unless
it just
shut it all down,
brain.
You know?
Right.
And
right.
That was what we were talking about this morning. Like this year, I was thinking this morning, I'm like, I haven't made a push like I'm making now in maybe 10 years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what has changed. And I was like, you know, I'm a frequent poster on Instagram. It's like how a lot of us connected, you know? And this year, like I filtered out so many people just, you know, because my thing is like, if that person bugs me, then it's my fault for consuming it. So unfollow. To a degree, unless it's an investigation we are completing.
Correct. Correct.
So I was thinking about like, there's always these people who are like, oh, I'm going to have this epic race. And then they go do their race and something happens and they don't finish, but they've already like made this big epic pre-post. You know what I mean? Like, how does that affect you afterwards? You know, we're only age groupers and I don't even know if that makes sense. But one of the things he was talking about today is like, you know, what if coming up into your next race, you just tried and see what happened if you don't post anything about it. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden that felt weird to me.
Right.
He's like, Mare, you used to race for 20 years without saying anything before. And
no,
isn't
it just
that
be your
that's
little,
another component.
It's just a little, it was your little group of training people.
Yeah.
And there wasn't, I mean, we weren't running races at that point. Already at mile 18 of a marathon, writing the Instagram post in our head.
Yeah.
Of why the race didn't go well.
Right.
Because it just wasn't a thing.
And that's like the new piece of sports psychology, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and I just like kind of realized that this morning, I'm like, geez, another layer. And that's all. A lot of it's self-imposed, you know, but what happens if we don't do it this time? Does it change anything? So I may try that experiment.
I mean, it's an interesting experiment for sure. And I think if you were to do it on the flip side, My first question would to you would be, how many times did you almost post a story?
Right.
How many times did you almost post, you know, something on the race, and then consciously had to pull yourself back and say, well, no, I said I wasn't going to do this. Because if you're just doing it to prove to yourself that you can,
yeah,
I don't know that it necessarily has the same effect.
That's a good point. Like, why am I posting it? I usually, like, I keep my Instagram private, and there's so many of us, like you and I became, wait, when did we meet? 10 years ago in Galveston. We met at
Galveston in 2014 or 2013.
Yeah. And the social media stuff has allowed us to become great friends over that. And if I didn't have it, we wouldn't have this friendship. You know what I mean? Or if you didn't have it, you know what I mean?
Agree.
Yeah.
And I do think that, as you know, your friend, I love seeing, oh my gosh, I love seeing Mary's swim workouts she posts. And you will post something and I'll be like, oh, I have a question about that.
Right. Or yeah. Yeah.
Life stuff. So it's, I think for our friends, it is a great way to keep in touch with what people are doing, yeah, but that circle naturally grows to these acquaintances and then other folks that you don't even really know at all. Mm-hmm. And then you get sucked into the, oh my gosh, they're so fast. Oh my gosh, they're training 100 right. miles a week. Oh my right. gosh, how are they doing this with 14 kids and a husband and a secret yeah. second family? And I can't run 50 miles a week.
Right. I guess it's the intention that we have. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and that's another reason why I keep it private, because I don't need the likes, but I genuinely wonder about people's preference of candy.
Well, that's important.
Or like, yeah, the other day I was like, I have tubeless tires on my race bike. What do you guys carry? You know, like, I got some really good tips, or the bra stuff, or I mean, we had a couple of years ago, we had Ratpalooza.
Oh, Ratpalooza. What a time. What a time.
In all honesty, when my dad died, oh my God, like, I was able to connect with so many people over, you know, Instagram story therapy.
Well, sadly, that's usually when social media is the best.
Yeah.
Right.
Because people were like, I've been through it. This is what I did. That's how I got connected with my grief therapist. I mean, you know what I mean? So maybe it all comes down to intention, because you know that there's those people. I call them in triathlon, like, the people in the morning and transition who are taking a selfie with every single person, you know, the duck face selfie, I'm half dressed, because they want to show people how many friends they have. Right. And then I think about, like, well, that's what they need to use it for. What do I need to use it for? I need it to be like, what do you think about disc brakes or pumpkins? It's always coming right. back to candy.
And I do think that that's fine, right? Yeah. Whatever you need to use it for
yeah.
is fine, as long as it's true to you and what yeah. you want and what yeah. you need, right?
And if you're depending on people's, if you're someone who needs that external validation to get through your day, I hope you have the insight to, like, look at that. You know what I mean? Like, if Instagram shut down tomorrow, I feel like I would know who I need to reach out to just to connect. You know what I mean? But right. like the likes, I don't think I would care about. I think earlier in our social media careers, we cared more because it was mm-hmm. like new. But yeah, I think you're right. It's the intention and just the interactions, you know? I mean, how would we know if people like Mellow Cream Pumpkins? Do you think I have an addiction?
Oh, we definitely have an addiction, which is why we can't send them to each other via Amazon.
Right, right.
Because if we didn't have an addiction, I could be like, oh, Mary had a really great race. I'm going to send her some Mellow Cream Pumpkins as a congratulations.
Awesome.
No, it wouldn't be awesome. It would be terrible.
Yeah, we can't do that. Wait. I'm derailing. Yeah. So yeah, I think, you know, unless we're in an investigational mode on social media, we got to be, you know, if people are posting something that irritates us, that's our fault for consuming it. You
it's
know?
Our fault for consuming it. That's why there's a mute button. That's why there's yeah. an unfollow button, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting how all that has, like, the technology, the social media, has all just added a new layer of complexity, I guess you could say, to racing, you know? Isn't that
to sport, to racing, yeah.
To life.
Yeah.
Like when your daughter was growing up, was she ever in a spot where social media didn't exist?
No, she's grown up with social media. So my daughter will be 19 in July, and she's grown up with social media.
Like we're the last generation who didn't have the internet.
Well, we are an interesting generation because we kind of, not kind of, we straddle the line, right? Between pre and post.
Right.
Right. So our parents never had, you know, it's we straddle digital and analog, right?
Yeah, right.
So we grew up until high school, you're actually reading encyclopedias in school.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And you're actually was considered right? a big deal.
Right. We didn't have AI to write our research papers. Yes. Yes. But we are young enough that if we went back to school today, we would have that.
Yeah. Like when right? when I did grad school, I think I just started in 2015. There was no problem, you know what I mean, to like jump back in. But I had a student when I was teaching. I think she was in her 60s. She was 60 years old and she came back to school. And, you know, we all looked at her and we're like, that chick's going to struggle. But she had already, she had figured it out by the time she got there. And she was one of the most proficient people. that's
oh, amazing.
We are like that last generation. Like when I was a new nurse, I was charting on paper. So yes. Then we went to electronic charting and Kurt was in the hospital in 2015 or 14 and the whole computer system shut down and they didn't know how to like give him pain medication or discharge him. And right. I was like, well, what about your immersion? You know, like I taught them, I wasn't even a nurse on this floor, but this group of nurses didn't know how to function without computers.
Right.
I was like, and we're trained to do it downtime, but it's so weird. Yeah.
You know what you know. You know what you've grown up in. You know, it's fascinating to look at. We're at such an interesting time, which I think leads to our last topic, right?
Oh, yeah. This is our,
the running boom, right?
The running boom. Is this
for correct? Those,
London had 850,000 applicants?
Correct.
And how many do they accept?
It's like a 35,000 person race.
What? How do you get into this?
You don't.
you play Mega Millions.
People,
you get first.
Over the past few years. So there's it's called the World Marathon Majors and it consists of six marathons, right? So it's Boston, New York, Chicago, Tokyo, London, Berlin, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started slowing down, I was trying to kind of redefine what's important to me or what's fun to me or what goals should I be shooting for that are outside of just time, right? And I was like, oh, a lot of people go after this six-star medal, right?
Yeah.
It's completing all of the world majors. And, you know, I had run Boston, I had run Chicago a couple times. And so I was like, all right, I'll start with London because that sounds like it would be fun. I've applied and been rejected to Berlin, London, and New York over 5, 6, 7 times each.
What?
And it's the popularity, my opinion.
Yeah.
These marathons, it's fun to go after a different goal. It's fun to go after six stars. And you can put it all over your social media. And they bring attention to it. And all these world majors the weekend of, it's like, come collect your six stars and let's see your six star medal, right?
Yeah.
And so there's this additional element. And then you have, you know, the women's distance running boom.
Oh, yeah.
Happening where the depth is crazy. The times are dropping. You've got fun shoes that have little trampolines in them, you know, and everyone seemingly wants to be a part of that, which is great. I love running so much. I want nothing more than for everyone to love running.
Yep.
But the downside of that, it reminds me of Ironman 10 years ago.
Yeah.
When I remember wanting to sign up for Ironman Arizona in 2016.
Yep.
So whatever the year before was, it opened and you had to have laptops open. You had to have signed into your account and it would sell out in 10 minutes.
I've camped out at Lake Placid after doing the race to get a spot.
Right.
When they had so vouchers. It's interesting
how it cycles through, right? Yeah. That was 10 years ago and it was Ironman. Now we're seeing these marathons that, you know, I'm running California International Marathon in December.
Right.
It's May right now. I signed up, I think, in April, and it was 90% sold out, which is not, not equivalent to what it was 10 years ago for Ironman, but you are. So now you've got companies like you either run for charity to get into these races. But when you have 850,000 people applying for a race, now it's harder to get in by a charity.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And then they can really up that amount. Because if you don't raise it, you pay it.
Well, right. And then there's a company called World Marathon Tours. And they put together an itinerary, right? So that's how people sometimes will buy a package through them. It includes your hotel. It includes your race entry and a couple other like people-y social engagements that I wouldn't be interested in. But it's a little package they put together. And that's how you used to be able to easily, well, I want to go and get into Berlin.
Right.
I'll just buy a package through Marathon Tours.
Right.
I reached out to them for London. I don't remember. Maybe it was last year. And they're like, well, you can sign up now. Or maybe it was Tokyo. And there's a 3-year waiting list.
What?
So it's even... even those types of ways to get in, you just, it's just time.
So do you keep applying? Just keep applying and keep applying and keep applying?
Every year. Was and it I think you who I was got talking to one of my friends who we were like, you know, we if we have to raise money for these, we just have to spread it out.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, the charity amount is low enough, I'm using air quotes, that you're just like, all right, I'll just eat it and pay for it myself.
Right. Right.
Instead of raising money. But then you just have to spread them out over years.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
Because it's money. I know Boston, I think the minimum you can raise now for any official charity for Boston is $10,000 or $11,000.
God.
I think New York is $5,000, right? Yeah. So it's these are not small chunks of change.
Yeah. I so feel maybe like it's
the
year
of the little podunk marathon. Maybe this is the year to do it.
My mom was just in podunk. No, there's a place in Tennessee where she went to a sewing convention. And I'm telling you, it was very similar to podunk. It might have been podunk. We'll have to follow up.
Actually, the name of the town.
Yeah. So, but that made me think of like when I raced with Lance and we raised $100,000 for teens living with cancer, which is now 1331 Cancer Connect. Like I hesitate to do any charities now because I can never ask again.
Right.
You know what I mean? That was such a one-off that I don't feel right asking anyone for any more money ever again in my life, except for a certain lawsuit, but that's a different story.
Another story for another day.
It's a story for another day. So yeah, say I got into a marathon every year and I was raising for charity, at some point you're going to be like, Jesus, stop asking me for money, Mary. So like, I feel like I've exhausted that already.
Well, and it's an interesting conversation because I ran for Boston Children's Hospital last year. I ran Boston.
Yeah.
For the Miles for Miracles. And there are folks on that marathon charity team that are 10 plus years. And they, you know, it's an interesting conversation because some of them are like, the more you do it year over year, people set that money aside because they know they're just going to put it towards your
fundraiser the next year.
And then other folks I did not run this year, a few of my teammates from last year ran again the second time. And they said, oh my God, it was so much harder this year.
Really?
So, and you know, she had mentioned like, I can't do this again because it's people are just not
giving.
It's a very interesting conversation. And, I don't know. I mean, there's not really a solution in terms of when your numbers are that high for London in particular.
What do you do?
You can't, you know, roads are only so wide. You can only have so many people. It is, I think Boston times, and this is the topic for another day, but we might see the Boston buffer get wider again.
Yeah. Because, yeah.
I don't know. It's an interesting time.
You know, it is science, an interesting time with
science, technology, training, coaching.
Yeah. And as the marathon boom is going up, the Ironman boom is starting to dwindle a little bit. I mean, when I started triathlon my third or fourth year, like then they brought Ironman Lake Placid. So like I remember what it was like when there was the only North American Ironman was Canada in Penticton. And then Ironman Lake Placid was new.
Like, wow.
It was amazing. You used to be able to qualify at an Olympic distance race.
That's
and
wild.
Now they're pulling the full distance Ironmans and putting more focus to 70.3, which I personally love because it's so much more doable with life. They turn into girls weekends for me. But yeah, it's very interesting. Now there's, I mean, Lake Placid, something's going to happen to Lake Placid because it's the 25th anniversary. The town's tired of us because we don't deserve to be there. And now they're going to have Ironman Ottawa 2 weeks later in 2025. They're not going to have two North American Ironmans 2 weeks apart.
No. So
we'll see what happens.
Do you think this will be the last year for Placid?
I would not be surprised. I think people believe that Lake Placid financially depends on the Ironman. But if you've ever gone to Lake Placid, there is so much going on and so much happening there. I don't know their exact financials, obviously, but like they're not dependent. It's nice boost, but people don't think about how many businesses gets closed that day on a Sunday before this race when triathletes are, you know, being very uncool. most triathletes are great, but like we got the bike course had to be rerouted a few times because people would literally defecate on other people's lawns.
So, oh, it's crazy. Bananas.
Yeah.
It is wild. I was there. Mm-hmm. I think I was spectating 1 year and there was a gentleman walking down the middle of the road, screaming at all the spectators about how much he hated that weekend because you trash our town. And then you leave. He was so angry and I can't imagine he's the only one.
Yeah. So I think it'll be interesting. I wonder if we've just put our time in and we've done our time, or do they change it to a half or something, which would also be cool, you know? So,
well, I think that's another, the running the marathon and the 70.3, a little bit synonymous in terms of being able to do it with life. Again, with the nutrition, with the sports psychologist, with the science, with the tech, you know, you can do it just a lot easier, maybe a lot faster, maybe a lot more efficient and effective than you can a full Ironman. Yeah. And maybe that's where people are navigating towards, right? Yeah. Everything's business.
Yeah. So, and I remember when they first had the first 70.3 World Championships, like in 2007, they had it in Clearwater. And a bunch of us are like, that's never going to work. And here we are.
Right.
And essentially they just rebranded the half Ironman name. And over the years, they've made it a whole thing. So they've done a good job with the marketing. And I will tell you when I go to a 70.3 and Ironman 70.3, I know what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
They have it so nailed down right now that there's no questions. Like I know exactly what I'm walking into next week. 4 weeks after that, I know exactly what I'm walking into. You know what I mean? They've really done a good job making it the athlete experience. So,
mm-hmm.
a lot going on. But the big question I have is, will Brock's ever sponsor the Ironman stuff?
Well, let's start with your podcast first. That's where they should start.
I mean, they probably should.
And then once you have them baited in, then we can go.
And I can be like, I have a friend named Iron Man.
Screw that. Any distance event, right? What would be cooler than finishing a marathon and in your after athlete bag is just a bag of candy corn or Mellows or jelly beans. That would be amazing.
Let's screw the protein drink. Right. Let's get on with it.
Right.
So now to close, I do have another hot topic. Are you ready for Emily in Paris?
I am so excited.
Okay. Let's first talk about Emily's bangs. Are they going to be back?
No, she's going to grow them out. But
those were trauma bangs.
More importantly, Emily in season one,
mm-hmm.
the whole series opens with her running in this yellow puffer jacket.
Yes. What is that? Who runs in that?
And then did you see her time?
Yeah. Yeah.
She ran like 5.1 miles in like 40 minutes or something. And I was like,
it's like when I watch a medical show and they're like, shock a flatline, which is impossible. I feel like I could be that consultant. I could also be the athlete consultant on Emily in Paris. Like number one.
She gave up running. And I feel like she didn't run last season.
We're not running in a puffer jacket.
No.
We're not like running that fast in a puffer jacket. Because it's obviously nice out and you don't understand weather. Like they need to have a little consult.
Right.
Now. Oh my God. What is Gabriel's girlfriend's name? The pregnant.
Camille.
Is she pregnant or is she lying?
So I think she is. And she's going to be in a sticky spot because.
Cheating on him with the girl. With her artist girlfriend.
She wants to be with the artist girlfriend.
Yes. But I feel like she feels like she should be with him.
But during the wedding, she was the one that stopped it and said, I know that you're in love with Emily.
Right. And then
so I'm out.
Alfie left Emily at the wedding.
Alfie needs to come back for at least a few cameos because he's too hot of a human to leave him off that show completely.
Yeah. I mean, so what is
it? And then Mindy, remember Mindy?
Yes.
Is in that big fancy singing show.
Is it a cabaret?
Yeah, right. No, she got invited. But I feel like it wasn't
there.
So I'm curious to see what happens with Mindy.
Yes. Because she broke up with the rich guy.
I know.
There's so
for those of you listening, if you haven't looked, there's a reel that lives out on Instagram that has all the cast members describe this season in like 4 words.
Yes, and I saw that. It's so confusing to me.
It's so good.
So we have to wait till August.
No, July.
July.
No, August. August, you're right. I think it's in two parts.
Right.
Oh, you're right. It's August and September. Oh, July is The Bachelorette. Sorry, that's my fault.
And Selling the OC just came out. So those of us, when we go to Chattanooga, we're waiting, like we're allowing each other to watch the first 4 episodes and then we're going to watch the rest in Chattanooga.
Oh, we're going to need to do a follow-up pod then because I have thoughts. I watched the first 4 episodes last night.
Oh my God.
Did
you get to the one where Sean and Austin had a fight? My God. I don't know who to believe. I kind of believe Austin.
I have thoughts.
Okay. Maybe we could save that for the next show.
Yes. We'll go from serious, deep thoughts of seasonal candy to serious, deep thoughts on terrible reality TV.
Yes, exactly. And I'll tell you, when they introduced me to this show last year, I was like, I don't watch stuff like that. Like, I'm educated. I read books. And then I'm like, whoa. Chriselle, what about Christine? Wait a second. So, and the same thing happened. I have a friend who's a PA and her husband is a physician. I mean, they're very educated people. And she sends me videos of him watching Selling Sunset.
No, it's the best. I feel like a large part of the audience is very well educated folks who work really hard and need to just let their brain melt.
Exactly.
In the evenings.
Exactly. So.
That and a bunch of probably 20-year-olds, but fine.
You're so right. Megan, this was so much fun. I hope I can edit it correctly and that it works. This is the first time I've ever on Zoom.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun. I love chatting with you. I'm so humbled to be your friend and I love our friendship and this was really great.
It's funny because Megan will be here for a few months in the fall and maybe we'll do it in person then. We just talked about it for a while and I was just being lazy.
That would be really be fun.
Why were we thinking we were going to do this in the evening?
I'll be in bed by 6.
We'll be fine.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Thank you. And stay in touch this week and we'll get thinking about our next one.
Sounds good.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.